Hello everyone and welcome to Negotiating Ideas, a podcast about political thought on democracy, pluralism, and peace. My name is Omar Sadr. This episode is on democratic backsliding in Eastern Europe. As you understand, while most of the advanced democracies are grappling with different challenges, and there is a risk of democratic backsliding in various parts of the world, the case of East European countries is different. Except Poland, Hungary, and Czech Republic, the rest of European, East European countries are doing very well in terms of democratic resilience. So, what explained this? My guest in this episode, Jan Revone, who is a professor of political science at Sciences Po Paris, has an answer for this. He has recently come up with an article titled "Antidote to the Backsliding, Ethnic Politics and Democratic Resilience," where he argues, quote, "Backsliding occurs most prominently in societies without politically organized ethnic minorities. Widely cited cases of democratic regression, Hungary and Poland, do not have significant politically organized ethnic minorities." Unquote. So in societies where there are, he argues, that there are ethnically mobilized political parties who are committed to constitutional liberalism and forge alliances with other liberal parties, there is high chance of democratic resilience. And this is the main factor which prevents democratic backsliding. Such kind of finding could be replicated in many other parts of the world, but I am going to discuss these and many other issues with Professor Jan in this episode. On to the podcast. Well, it's so much pleasure to have you, Jan Revone. Thank you for your time to come to Negotiating Ideas.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Well, I was struck to read your recent article on democratic backsliding and minorities in Eastern Europe. And to my mind, it presents us quite unique findings on how can we re-understand, reimagine democratic backsliding, but also contribution that minorities may have in certain form of very pluralistic societies vis-a-vis those societies which are homogenous. So my first question is, let me just give you a very broad question. Tell the audience what is unique about your article.
Mm-hmm. So the core argument of the article is that we start with the point of view of the minorities, right? What do minorities want in a given society? And I think the basic thing that we would expect an ethnic minority group, which is somehow defined by their specific culture or language or perhaps religion, depending on where they are, the key interest would be group self-preservation. And now minorities might face different opportunities for ensuring such preservation. And one of them would, of course, be self-government, which would probably be the most favored one. But in many situations in the world, including in the part of the world that I was studying, that's Eastern Europe, they're rarely able to basically break out of the state in which they are and create their own polity in which they could run their own government. So I call these permanent minorities, permanent in the sense that they are stuck in a polity in which they are a minority and which they can be trumped by a political majority. So what is their main interest in this context? And I would argue that broadly speaking, the interest in this context would be to somehow constrain the majority. And if democracy is one of the options, which in the part of the world that I was studying, it is kind of the game, or at least it's expected to be the game, then one very effective way to constrain the majority is to follow the institutions of liberal democracy, which particularly prescribe not just electoral competition, but also counter-majoritarian constraints on majority rule. And so in a sense, ethnic minorities, I think quite intuitively, are concerned with the tyranny of the majority, and they wish to seek ways to constrain and limit this tyranny of the majority by having institutional and procedural constraints on what the majority can do towards minorities of all kinds. So that would basically lead me to expect that in democratic contexts, ethnic minorities will be champions of liberal democracy that will seek these counter-majoritarian checks and balances. And this is new for two reasons, right? There are two main things that the literature in the past has expected of ethnic minorities that I think this challenges. The first one is that most people think that ethnic politics are generally detrimental to democracy and to the proper functioning of a modern effective state. And my argument suggests that, on the contrary, ethnic politics under some conditions can bolster democracy. It can be normatively a good thing. And secondly, the literature has often expected ethnic politics to be about particularism. Ethnic groups want something for themselves. It's all about just we for our people. And this challenges that view. It basically says ethnic minority status can actually infuse the group representatives with ideological aims. And so ethnicity can actually inform ideology.
Yeah. So this is, I mean, unique in the sense that you bring a nuance and the democratic theory, but also you reconfirm the fundamental assumptions of liberalism, wherein counter-majoritarianism and within the liberal framework works. Now, my question would be some recent theories of pluralism and also North American, let's say, multiculturalism will say merely liberal framework and counter-majoritarianism may not be able to provide the ability for minorities to fulfill their goals, what you said, preserve their identity, but also ensure that they have a stake in the system. So that's why they go a bit forward and say, well, minorities needs to be protected under certain kind of institutional arrangements. For example, recognition of rights and all that. So now my question is, did you come across in the Eastern European cases where those kind of circumstances where minorities go beyond this liberal assumptions and also accommodate certain form of arrangements of multiculturalism?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the big debates in liberalism is whether individual liberal rights are sufficient to provide support for groups. Right. And classical liberals would argue that, yes, they are, by virtue of their individual rights. Individual members of minority groups can create associations that will protect them. A vast majority of minorities, and certainly all of the ones that I have encountered and discussed with, are interested in group rights. They're interested in very elementary group rights, such as having the right to have their children educated in the minority language. So having access to minority language education or having access to basic state services in minority languages. Now, keep in mind that Eastern Europe ethnicity is dominantly, though not solely, dominantly determined by language spoken. So one of the key concerns in places like Estonia or Slovakia is whether the minorities can have education in their language, whether they can have state institutions engage them and cater to them and give them services in their language. They would all argue that these group rights are essential to them, but they would probably also agree with some of the liberal theorists, most of them coming from Canada, who argue that these group rights are actually a core of the liberal ideal, right? Yeah. That in a sense, these individuals need the collective in order to make sense of their own lives. Mm. And furthermore, the state is never culturally neutral. Mm. And therefore, a liberal state needs to have this flexibility of providing some of these group rights to the minorities in order to kind of broaden the cultural focus of the state, which normally is just majoritarian.
Yeah. So it also is the cases that you call it successful in Eastern Europe are unique in a sense that at the current moment, most of the plural societies, including, for example, here in the U.S., major European countries are facing existential crisis in terms of coexistence. We had some time that we agreed on fundamental assumptions and values of our society. Now we don't have. How Eastern European countries, particularly those who are, you say, they are diverse in terms of their sociocultural composition, have been able to come up with such kind of solid success?
Well, I mean, the success was mixed, right? And the success remains mixed. There are big divergences in the level of ethnic minority rights across the countries that I've studied. I've cited Estonia and I've cited Slovakia. The level of protection that the Estonian minorities, and I'm particularly thinking of the Russian speakers in Estonia, the level of protection that they have today is far lower than, say, the protection of many linguistic minorities in Austria-Hungary 150 years ago, right? So the success, I think, is rather partial. What I suppose is particular for Central Eastern Europe is its trajectory away from communism and its geographic location in the very close proximity to Western Europe, which has been both economically and politically successful at liberal democracies, right? So for Eastern Europe, the clear path in the aftermath of communism was towards democracy. They were in a way facing this clear option that was pointed to by their neighbors. They were helped by various Western organizations, particularly including the European Union, to go down the democratic path. And so this has, in a certain way, influenced the elites, both the majority elites and the minority elites, to emulate, to some degree, right, and more or less successfully, democracies. But what is important here to note is that it was always the minorities who were much more fundamentally and profoundly keen on the democratic processes, while the majorities were sometimes, giving it lip service, but not necessarily effectively putting it into place. And so you will see various moments of Eastern European history over the last 30 years, when it was ethnic minorities that have explicitly pushed for democratization or greater consolidation of democracy.
Sure. And the article, you argue that it focused on three key actors, and those are mobilized ethnic minorities, constitutionally liberal parties, which are, I mean, to you, these will be the majority parties, and finally, illiberal parties, asserting primacy of ethnically defined dominant identity. Yes. Now, to me, one missing actor would be illiberal minority parties in this equation. What if in a scenario you have those kind of parties, which are, for example, as you define illiberalism, as an ethno-populist or anti-pluralist? Yeah. How that equation will change everything?
Well, look, all of these ethnic minority groups, they are not inherent liberals. In fact, I'm working on a book manuscript about this. This article is sort of one component, one relatively small component of that manuscript, which looks at the systemic outcomes. But the whole manuscript looks at how ethnic minorities' preferences are formed, political parties are shaped, and how they engage political issues and ultimately shape political systems. It is absolutely clear that ethnic minorities are no inherent liberals. In fact, the book manuscript is called Circumstantial Liberals. Okay. The idea is that they are very much the same human beings as anybody else, with some important exceptions. One of the important exceptions is their concern for the collective, right? Because they seek to protect this collective group identity that is not protected by the state, or a priori not protected by the state. And so they take greater solace in their collective culture, which might have actually various consequences for them being rather collectivist, sometimes quite socially conservative, potentially patriarchal, right? So in many ways, they are not liberal. Hmm. But in the context in which they exist, they always consider, what are my options for protecting myself, right?
Right.
And you might have various options for doing this. One option could be, let's break the polity and either join an ethnic kin state or create our own state, which would mean that we will basically become the majority, and then the effect of this minority liberalism disappears. That's one option. Another option is democracy, right? And trying to build these counter-majoritarian institutions. That's probably, normatively speaking, the best outcome. But then there is the third possibility. The third possibility is to say, look, we're just going to create some kind of a collusive situation with other majority illiberals or anyone else, and we're just going to kind of cohabit together. We'll give them votes, they'll give us pork, and we will live happily together. What's wrong with this situation? The problem with the situation is that it's purely instrumental, right? It works as long as it works for everyone, but it is not done by the majority illiberal partner because they like minority rights. It's done by the illiberal partner because it somehow suits them in the current situation. The moment it stops suiting them, they will probably turn around and drop the minority and all concerns for their rights or any other needs that they might have. So the minority would naturally be very concerned, right? So there is, even though you can create these various corrupt illiberal cartels, there is always going to be the push for coming up with some form of a more permanent protection. And this is where you start thinking, could we build some form of institutional controls that would prevent the majority from the moment we're not useful enough or there's someone more useful, they just drop us and throw us into jail potentially, right? So there is this inherent need for some form of institutional protection. And this is why I would argue, you know, that that there really is a natural push towards this counter-majoritarian construction. Right. So yes, we see a lot of illiberal collusion, but this illiberal collusion does not undermine that hope for the liberal constraints, because those liberal constraints are more permanent.
So if we move beyond this institutional liberal constraints, the second actor, which you call it constitutionally liberal parties. So clearly this is a political liberalism, and you also cautiously differentiate and you take a stance that you do, you're not interested, at least in the article, to, on the issues related, like cultural liberalism. This reminds me, if you move on from East Europe towards, let's say, Middle East, some of the Muslim conservative, but also what they call it Muslim Democrats, let's say in Tunisia, in Turkey, for instance, the ruling party, or in Egypt, Muslim Brotherhood, they accept constitutional arrangements within a kind of democratic framework. But culturally, they are conservative. For example, when it comes to divorce, when it comes to alcohol consumption, restriction of certain form of other way. But now the dilemma in Middle East has been that you guys are culturally not liberal, so that's why we do not trust you guys. Though they accept democracy, like what happened in Egypt in 2013-14, right? How do you suggest that we copy the experiences of Eastern Europe, if it is about all political liberalism, not cultural liberalism?
Yes. Well, so let me just start by saying the article, I mean, and it's much more clearly in the book, the article makes an allusion to the fact that liberalism has at least three dimensions, right? The first one is economic. Economic liberals want markets and less state intervention. Second one is cultural, as you say, that has to do with, are we going to follow traditional, often religious prescriptions, or are we going to allow individual rights of, you know, life choices, identities, and so on and so forth. Those two dimensions of liberalism are relatively unimportant in this context. What's most important is the third dimension, and that's what I call constitutional liberalism, or what you refer to as political liberalism. That's mainly the acceptance of the principles of liberal democracy, including checks and balances and counter-majoritarian rules, right? That is the critical part. And it's absolutely true that in Central and Eastern Europe, some of the constitutional liberal parties were either economic non-liberals, right? They were often socialist parties. And at times, the Slovak example would work here, they were Christian Democrats. So they were conservative religious parties, conservative in the sense of cultural conservatives, but they were constitutional liberals. So in this sense, I mean, again, I'm not a specialist on the Middle East, but I completely understand that there could be someone who might accept certain teachings of Islam while being a constitutional liberal. So as long as you accept the structures and institutions and practices of liberal democracy, whatever you think about the role of religion, I mean, as long as it does not limit liberal democracy, right? As long as religion is subordinated to liberal democracy, then it's perfectly fine.
And then let's go to another example somewhere in Middle East, a Persian country like Afghanistan. In the last 20 years, before fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban, the country had a kind of very fragile democracy. And Afghanistan is a kind of multi-ethnic society, which are, you don't have clear-cut majority and minority because all ethnic groups are below 50%. But the fact is, I think one of your assumptions is, you can test it there and say confirmed, that most of the non-dominant, politically non-dominant ethnic groups like the Persian Tajiks, Hazaras, they were pro-democracy. And let's say at least limited to constitutional liberalism. But what happened is that this democracy could not sustain. Probably, of course, dynamics are quite fundamentally different in Afghanistan because of the youth prisons. But now, question would be, to what extent your hypothesis could be tested elsewhere and say, let's have here also we have successful case?
Look, this is a very good question, and I've been pushed on this quite a bit as I've discussed this with colleagues. So I've already told you that there is something probably specific about Central and Eastern Europe in the sense that it has this both economic and ideological anchoring to Western Europe, and especially through the process of European integration, even though, you know, we can question the extent to which the EU has been successful in pushing democracy onto these countries, it has been to a certain extent. So I would not want to underestimate the importance of not being far from Germany, Sweden, Italy, right? I think that really matters.
True.
In terms of economic stability and in terms of just the fact that there were people who went directly to Eastern European parliaments and talked to the leaders of the government and of the opposition. This is how we run things. This is how we do things. This is what we don't do. That certainly mattered. Now, I am quite convinced that the fundamental mechanisms of what I'm describing here should work more or less universally, right? What, of course, will matter is the context. The context will be particular because there's always that circumstantial decision of these minorities of what's going to be more effective for me. And so I want to make it clear, right, that in certain contexts, these minorities can be staunch anti-democrats. In fact, in the book, I have a case of the Sudeten Germans. They were the German minority of Czechoslovakia up until the mid-1940s when they were forcibly expelled. And what's very interesting about them is that they were initially staunch royalists, generally. They supported Austria-Hungary. They did not want to see the creation of Czechoslovakia. When Czechoslovakia was created and it was the only game in town, most of them became staunch Democrats. Mm. And they supported a multicultural democracy in Czechoslovakia. This fell apart only in the context of Hitler gaining power in Germany, when suddenly there was a real possibility of them exiting their minority status and becoming a part of a greater German nation. And at that point, many of them switched and became Nazis. So, not necessarily individuals, but if you think of the typical voter of this group, they went from being royalists to Democrats to Nazis. So that's the circumstantial conditions. What, however, is consistent is this continuous need for protection via some form of limitation of the majority. Right. And so in the conclusion of the book, I have focused on three cases that are outside of Eastern Europe. Two of them are established democracies. One of them is not. I've looked at Muslims in France, and I've noted that Muslims in France, looking at various data, are more concerned about the functioning of French democracy than French majority nationals. Right. They're much more concerned about what would happen if the National Assembly in France was dismissed, because they're concerned about the rights that are being protected by French liberal democracy. Mm. The same thing obviously goes for African Americans in the United States. They're far more concerned about American democratic institutions, and they're far less likely to buy into various conspiracy theories by quasi-liberals such as Donald Trump. So, for example, if you look at how African Americans perceived the presidential election of Joe Biden, they overwhelmingly agreed that it was fair, while only a much smaller share of white Americans agreed with that statement, right? And then finally, I take it to a more problematic and more distant democracy, which is Malaysia. Malaysia is sort of a quasi-functional democracy, but there we have seen over the course of the 60 years that the country's been independent, that it was actually the minority Chinese and Indians who have systematically put forward political parties that have challenged the cartel put together by the dominant Malays. And if you look today at the Asia Barometer, both Chinese and even more so Indian minorities are significantly more likely to agree that democracy is a better political system than others. Hmm. So I suspect that, you know, the fundamental concern for rights and for self-preservation is probably going to work universally. What matters is the conditions, is the circumstances under which these particular groups operate that might lead them, like the Sudeten Germans, to be either staunch opponents of democracy or staunch proponents.
Yeah. And one other thing which is unique about East European countries is the form of political system. Correct me if I'm wrong, but except Poland and Lithuania, which are semi-presidential system, the rest are parliamentary systems. So that's why this...
Romania is also semi-presidential. So actually many of them are semi-presidential, right? So
Yeah, I mean,
you're right. So what is particular about presidentialism is... obviously, the person of the president is one person. That person can come from one ethnic group at a time. Now, I would still argue that this should work anywhere where you need some form of a collective support for the government and collective support for the opposition. And what I've studied in the context of places like, for example, Estonia, is the way that you know, Estonia actually first tried to completely block the Russian minority out of the political process, first by not giving them citizenship, and second by kind of trying to push them out of representation. So that was the initial response to the presence of this very large minority. However, while that was happening, there was always the potential use of these people. There was always a political force, right? There was always someone in the opposition who was thinking, if I could get these Russians to vote for me, if I could get them to vote, and if I could get them to vote for me, I could potentially do better and potentially win elections. So there's always that calculus that exists. So as long, even if you have a presidential system, as long as there is some kind of an elected assembly that somehow controls that president, and that can vote for or against the laws that the president proposes, these dynamics are going to be in place. Mm-hmm. And there will be someone sitting in that assembly thinking, if I could get these groups to vote for me, then I'm going to do better than others. And it is useful to get minority groups to vote for you, because once you get their support, they will stick with you, right? Mm-hmm. Their interests are deeply socially rooted. Their organizations tend to be very socially rooted. And ethnic voters tend to be very loyal to their political organizations, because it carries more than just political identity. It carries personal ethnic identity.
Yeah. So, but also, I mean, the question was, if in case we have a system where it is presidential, hardcore presidential, and the electoral system is SNTV, which doesn't allow political parties representation, probably that will shift the dynamics wherein political parties may not be able to form and then negotiate with each other.
Right. Then it would depend on the territorial concentration of these minorities, right? So if they are territorially concentrated in areas where they could win some seats in these districts, then of course there would be surely a big discussion about how those districts are drawn, whether you're trying to sort of minimize the possibility for minority candidates to win, of course.
Yeah, yeah. One other challenge of pluralistic societies wherein ethnic politics is quite strong is kind of what we may call it ethnic entrepreneurship, wherein certain form of elite try to represent themselves as the sole, for example, leader of a group, and then negotiate on their behalf, but for a certain form of kind of patrimonial gains, personal gains. Yes. And this is, how Eastern European countries try to avoid such kind of system, probably in certain countries like Iraq or Lebanon. It is constitutional form of arrangement which has paved the way for such form of ethnic entrepreneurship.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing that we do not have in Central Eastern Europe is consociationalism, right? So the pillarization, I think, is particularly a problem, because it provides the opportunity for this form of hijacking of the interests of the minority by who knows whom. Now, you know, there's always going to be competition within groups. And this competition, at least in my sample that I study for Eastern Europe, I see that this competition is much more likely to be when the groups are big, right? Because there are just simply more votes to go around. So you can compete for these interests with various political parties around political personalities. I don't think that's necessarily so much different in Central Eastern Europe. It's often the personalities who build their parties around themselves. What I've noted in my study of this is that when you have bigger, and by bigger, I mean 10% plus minorities, you often get more parties, but it's always the bigger parties that are more moderate. And I'm not saying what comes first, right? Obviously, you're moderate, so you get more votes. You get more votes because you're moderate. But that's important, the fact that the moderation and the vote share are correlated. And it's the small parties that are all over the place. They could be very radical, very sort of ethno-nationalist radicals, or they could be moderates. But they are small. They're irrelevant. They're allowed to be irresponsible in a sense. The fact that the big ones are more moderate is the important component here. So that has kind of undermined the dynamic of having, let's say, leaders that would push for a more, ethnically extremist agendas in Central and Eastern Europe. And simultaneously, I mean, even in the context of Central Eastern Europe, you have to cooperate with others. You have to cooperate with other groups, either other minorities or, more importantly, with other members of the majority. And so very often the members of the majority who are likely to talk to you as a minority will be the liberals, right? Mm. With a small L, whoever they are. They might be socialists. They might be Christian Democrats. They might be liberals. You need to be able to work with them. And so to be able to work with them, you need to propose something that's a little bit better than we're just going to steal together.
Yeah.
Because again, you can steal together and they have sometimes stolen together, but there is no long-term trust building in this context, because you know that if it's all about stealing, and if you find someone you can do it better with, you will go with them. Mm. So I could go into specific cases, right, where there has kind of been a long-term learning and rapprochement between these types of forces, so moderate ethnic minority representatives and various forms of liberally minded majorities who then started working together and were able to beat majority illiberals at elections and in some ways really change the direction of the regime.
Right, right. So coming to the last, I mean, as a concluding remarks, your article presents a kind of correlationship between pluralism on one hand, democracy on the other hand, and constitutional liberalism. I wonder whether if such kind of conducive environment, which is here in Central East European countries for a kind of pluralistic democracy, could be also replicated elsewhere. Let's say if we take liberalism from out of equation in an illiberal context, can we have a kind of pluralistic democracy? The fact is that liberalism is a key and undeniable prerequisite of such kind of formula.
I think the argument that I've been trying to make here is that liberalism is very important in the sense that it comes with institutions and codified processes, right, that are going to be more trustworthy than just cooperation on good faith. Now, cooperation on good faith can probably also be institutionalized. And if I, again, my cultural references will be European, but if I think of pluralistic but not democratic societies that I can think of, I mean, that would be Ottoman Empire, that would be Austria-Hungary. They were pluralistic, but they were not democratic. It was certainly better to live in these places than to live in, number of others, Imperial Russia. But I don't think anyone would want to go back to them. So the liberal component, again, makes it much better because it's not just on good faith and some kind of a, cultural habitus. It is a constitutional principle with institutions that are built and that are upheld as a game in town that hopefully most subscribe to. So in this sense, I think pluralism without democracy is certainly possible, but it's suboptimal.
Right, perfect. So with that note, I think we come to the end of this episode. Thank you so much, Jan Ravi, for your time. And I will encourage the audience to read this wonderful article, which is titled Antidote to Backsliding, Ethnic Politics and Democratic Resilience in Eastern European Countries.
Thank you very much for your time and for your great questions. It was a pleasure.